Get hooked on Tuesday at Bonefish Grill with our three-course menu. You get a salad, your choice of entree like our new cod piccata, sirloin steak, or chicken teriyaki bowl, and an amazing dessert for only $14.99. So hurry in every Tuesday. And don't forget, stone crabs are back at Bonefish Grill, fresh off the Florida docks and served the way they were meant to be served. Chilled, cracked, and ready for dipping in our signature house-made mustard sauce. Come see what's in season at Bonefish Grill.
Blog Talk Radio.
If I knew then what I know now, no, I wouldn't change much of anything anyhow. It was 50-50, and I won the coin toss when you danced with me at the Huntington's Waltz. When you danced with me at the Huntington's Waltz.
Good afternoon and welcome to Help 4-HD Live. This is a special episode. I am Sharon Thomason. I'm the Executive Secretary and Director of Education with Help 4-HD, and our very special guest tonight is Alan Pfeffer. Alan is a retired attorney from New York who's very active with HD advocacy. Good evening, Alan. It's so good to have you with us.
Hi, Sharon. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit first about what your connection with Huntington's is?
Sure. Unfortunately, I'm a second-generation caregiver. My first wife had Huntington's, and now my adult daughter, Cherise, who will be 36 in 2 weeks, has Huntington's, and she was diagnosed in 2010.
She would have been about 20 when she was diagnosed?
No, she was diagnosed about 6 years ago. So she
six
was
years
almost,
ago, so about 30. Okay.
Yeah, 30. Yeah. So I've been doing a lot in New York. I serve as a volunteer on a health department, New York State Health Department advisory committee for its Centers of Excellence program for neurodegenerative diseases, which created three new dedicated nursing home wings for orphans and so we added 80 beds or 68 beds to the system, most of which will be for Huntington's patients. And I've also worked
That's amazing.
Medical... Yeah, it is. It really is. It was a long journey, but it paid off. And I got Huntington's included in the state's medical marijuana law in 2014. I know that's
so
not
you've
what we
done
want to
a wide variety of advocacy.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just a single issue. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing this for 6 years.
Yeah, and you're the advocacy chair of the Albany affiliate of HDSA.
Yes,
is that
that's
correct. Okay,
yes,
and then you also go ahead.
Yeah, we formed an affiliate. We formed an affiliate a few years ago, and this year we applied to become a chapter. So in January, we will officially be a chapter in the Albany chapter. Yeah. And I have to tell you that I'm motivated in my advocacy by my very courageous daughter, who, when she was diagnosed, told me very, very strongly that I'm not going to be in the closet. I'm not going to be a secret. I'm going to do my best to educate people about Huntington's. And in the subject we want to talk about today, death with dignity, she's had very strong, long-time beliefs on the subject.
That's wonderful that she is so willing to be out there and help educate people, because that's the only way we're ever going to make a difference with this disease. And, you know, Absolutely. Our slogan for Help for HD is educating the world about Huntington's disease. And there's a lot of work to be done there. I also know that you volunteer on the New York State Department of Health Advisory Committee for its Center of Excellence program for neurodegenerative diseases. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, after about 3 years of extensive lobbying of the nursing home industry, the governor's office, we got the governor, Governor Cuomo, to announce a $5 million program to create this Centers of Excellence. And they funded three nursing homes. New York has had, for a very long time, only one nursing home with a Huntington's wing in Manhattan. There in Cardinal Cook.
Cardinal Cook. Mm-hmm.
Cook, which a lot of people know about because it's been there for a long time. I have 48 beds. But what happened was, in part of the Medicaid reform that the governor did when he first came into office, was to put a stop to sending anyone on Medicaid to a nursing home outside of New York State. And the Huntington's disease in New York is very dependent upon a nursing home in Lee, Massachusetts, and two nursing homes in New Jersey. And so we, you know, a group of us, pretty much we had statewide representation, sought to create resources within the state. You can't stop sending people out of state if you don't have the resources in the state. Was our,
exactly.
Our,
yeah, if you've only got 48 beds, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and they would only take very late-stage patients, and there was always a long waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in Buffalo, which is 400 miles from New York City, it's very difficult to visit. And so one of the nursing homes in New Hartford, which is near Utica, they're going to have 32 beds. They opened in August. That's called Citrin, the Citrin Healthcare Center. And the other one, which is going to have 38 beds, which my daughter recently moved into, is in Rhinebeck, New York. And they're part of the Arch Care system, the same as Terrence Cardinal Cook.
Now, where is Rhinebeck?
Rhinebeck is about 60 miles south of Albany. I live in Albany, the Albany area.
Uh-huh.
And on the east side of the Hudson River, if you were looking at a map and you saw Kingston, and then you went east for a few miles, a little bit northeast, you'd see Rhinebeck on the other side of the Hudson.
Mm-hmm. So you have your daughter within an hour's drive.
Yes, yes. She's just about an hour, which is great.
I know that that's got to be comforting to you because it makes it a lot easier for you to go and see her and check on things. One
important
of the things that you mentioned that your daughter is very clear about are her views about death with dignity. And that's the topic of our show today. So tell us a little bit about what exactly is death with dignity.
Well, not everybody is fortunate enough to have a peaceful death in their sleep. A lot of people have a death that is accompanied by a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. And sometimes that suffering is mental, sometimes it's physical. And, you know, my daughter watched her mother, 19 years in a nursing home, go all the way. She did not pass from aspirated pneumonia, which many people with Huntington's pass from. And so she basically said, you know, I don't want to be like that. And she's filled out all of the permitted healthcare proxies that allow you to terminate medical care and, you know, not be resuscitated, not have a feeding tube. So death with dignity takes that one step beyond, and it allows the patient to ask the physician for aid in dying. And it's usually barbiturates. And the patient, if and when they want, within the time period allowed in the law, which is usually 6 months of what they perceive of as being the natural death, can take it and have a peaceful, painless end without having to, you know, deteriorate further or suffer further pain. And in
so
the
they
States,
essentially go to sleep.
Yes. In the United States, it's only open for people who have a terminal illness. And so it's people who know they are dying and, you know, don't want to suffer all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of us who have lived with HD have seen a lot of suffering, and so that brings up the question of what is the opposition to having a law that would allow someone a way out of that suffering. And I need to add here that Help for HD is not advocating for or against these laws. We believe that everybody should be informed and should make their own personal decisions about whether they would like to utilize such a law if it were available. So what's the opposition, Alan?
Well, there's in New York, which is the state that I study the most, and I think it's similar in the other jurisdictions, there are a few interest groups that are opposed to this. The first is the Roman Catholic Church. Not all religious organizations, but there are a few other religious organizations that have the same opinions as the Catholic Church, and they are opposed to it for religious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people, a disability group, and they're called I'm Not Dead Yet. They are people who have natural disabilities from birth, but not the type that are a terminal illness. And they are concerned. They are concerned that society may seek to euthanize them because they are. They don't, you know, because they have some disabilities, people that might be short, you know, people who might have autism. Neither of those things cause death, but they feel that there's a potential for being marginalized. And I also understand that the African-American community has some concerns because they feel that historically our medical society has discriminated against them. And so they feel that insurance companies may refuse to treat them, but offer them, you know, death with dignity, but refuse treatment. So that's a concern that they have. And I think that's probably somewhat of a general concern that people have, that, you know,
so that it might be used as a cost containment measure.
Right, right. So, you know, we see the religious arguments, you know, morphing into a fear mechanism that says, well, it's the beginning of the slippery slope. You know, government is going to control us. And, you know, first it's terminally ill people, and then maybe it'll be somebody else. And nobody has the right to do this except God. So, you know, there's a lot of the opposition has a lot of fear in it as opposed to, you know, how does it actually work? And what's the experience in Europe? And what's the experience in Oregon, where it's been in place since 97.
So part of your job as an advocate is to answer these groups who are opposed to death with dignity legislation. And what kind of answers do you give them?
Well, when we're faced with religious-based arguments, I basically take the position that everybody is entitled to their religious beliefs. Nobody has to choose a death with dignity. They don't have to. And in fact, there are a fair number of people in Oregon who have asked for the medicine so that they have a sense of control, but never actually take it. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, where I really want Huntington's patients to have this control and choice, because as you know, so many people with Huntington's choose to end their lives very early in their progression because they feel so, whereas if they knew they had control over the end, they would maybe choose not to do that so early. And so what I say to the religious arguments is everybody's entitled to their belief, but we have a secular society and our laws are not made based on any one religion. So you're entitled to your opinions, but you can't enforce them on somebody else. Everybody should have a choice. And to our African-American community, I would tell them that the two things, that the statistics in Oregon don't show any discrimination against minorities. In fact, the people who use it are, the percentage is overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly upper middle class. And so that's the statistics. And I would also tell them that within the last 2 weeks, the District of Columbia just enacted a death with dignity law. And as we know, the majority of the population in the District of Columbia are African Americans. And to the I'm not dead yet folks, I would point out that they're basing their argument on people with disabilities as opposed to people with a terminal illness. So, you know, they're talking about entirely different groups of people. Our society has a history of discriminating against people with disabilities. That's why we have the Americans with Disability Act. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about people who have a terminal illness.
Okay, so it's important to make the distinction that this is a secular law. It's not a religious law. As it's written, it would be a choice, not something that someone is forced to do. And
that's correct.
It addresses the terminally ill and not the generally disabled population. Is that pretty much it in a nutshell?
That's correct. In fact, the law specifically provides that a disability is not a basis for making the request for aid in dying.
Okay. In a minute, we're going to get into some of the specific criteria that are in this legislation. But first, can you tell me, you've mentioned Oregon and the District of Columbia. Who else currently in the United States has a death with dignity law?
The state of Washington, the state of Vermont, California, and on Tuesday, Election Day, Colorado approved it. And there is a court decision in the state of Montana that also allows it.
Okay, so in Montana, it's I assume somebody took it to court and got a ruling from the state Supreme Court rather than there being a change in legislation. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding. Talking about court decision, it reminded me of one other group that is in opposition, and that is a lot of doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it's not our job because they don't look at it as ending pain. You know, nobody disputes that hospice or palliative care are part of physicians' jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, this is ending pain, ending suffering. But there
mm-hmm.
is a segment of the medical population. In fact, the key thing that allowed it to pass in California was that the State of California Medical Society changed its official position from opposed to neutral.
Oh, okay. So they didn't support it, but they didn't oppose it either.
Correct.
Okay. And so the American Medical Association, do they have a stance on this?
I'm really glad you mentioned that because it's my understanding that sometime in November, and it may have happened already, I don't know, but I don't think it has, the American Medical Association is going to review its position, which is currently opposed, and reevaluate it. And so I've been asking people to write the American Medical Association and
mm-hmm.
to inform them that we don't want to be left behind again.
Okay, and let me tell our listeners that you have provided us with a letter that is already written with the email addresses of the contacts at the American Medical Association, a letter asking for this law, for the American Medical Association to support this law as it applies to Huntington's disease. And that letter is available on our Facebook page for Help for HD Live. You can download it and sign it and send a hard copy, or you can copy and paste it into an email. But Alan has provided that if this is something that you would like to advocate for. There's also another letter that you provided me with, and I believe the second letter is addressed on a state legislative level. Is that correct?
Well, I think if I sent you the right letter, it's to the president of Compassion and Choices, Barbara Coombs-Lee.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Hope I sent you the right letter.
You did. You did.
One of the organizations that is the proponent of death with dignity nationally is Compassion and Choices. They used to be known as the Hemlock Society, but they changed
mm-hmm.
their name a few years ago, and they kind of split off. And they are pushing the Colorado model nationally. In every state, they're trying to get the law replicated in California, in every state as it is in Oregon. And,
okay.
You know, the core problem here is that the way the law is drafted, you have to be able to talk, you have to be able to write, and you have to be able to self-administer, and you have to be competent to make a contemporaneous request when the doctors have determined that you are within 6 months of death. And no one with Huntington's, when they are within 6 months of death, can meet that definition. And there are other neurological illnesses where the people cannot meet those rigid requirements also. ALS,
mm-hmm.
Alzheimer's, although Alzheimer's is even a more difficult disease to fit into this program. And so what I'm trying to do is get the Huntington's community not only to write the American Medical Association, but to write the group that is advocating compassion and choices, and tell them, you're leaving us out. Let's do this through a healthcare proxy so that we're not left out.
Okay, explain to our listeners what a healthcare proxy is. Some may not be familiar with that term.
Sure. A healthcare proxy is a written document that anyone can fill out talking about what types of medical care they want and what they don't want. And usually they name a healthcare proxy, usually a relative, to tell the medical authorities that this is what my loved one has expressed. They've told me it orally, and here it is in writing. And it usually has things in it like, yes, I would like hospice care when I can no longer. Oh, and it becomes effective when the person is no longer able to communicate what their choices are. So the quintessential example is a person in a coma.
I guess the other case might be if the court has declared the person incompetent.
Person is incompetent, or the person is in a coma, and they can no longer make their decision. If they have a healthcare proxy in place, the proxy can affect what the person's choices are. So some people would say, yeah, keep me alive. Don't take me off that ventilator. And some people would say, no, if I'm in a persistent vegetative state, I don't want to, you know, survive on a ventilator. Take me off the ventilator. Stop feeding me. Don't, you know, feed me intravenously. And if I have a heart attack, don't resuscitate me. They usually talk about what they want in terms of hydration and food and medicine and other end-of-life decisions. So that's basically what a healthcare proxy is. And today, it's very, very common if you go into a hospital for anything at all, they ask you, do you have a healthcare proxy? And if you say no, they hand you a form. It's, in New York, it's called a MULST form. And you fill it out right then and there.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem here may be that in every state, it's going to be a little bit different. I know here in Florida, my son, who has Huntington's, has a living will, he has a DNR, and he has a paper that names me as his healthcare surrogate. So there are three different documents that are required in Florida. And those documents may vary from one state to another.
Sure, but the one thing that is uniform, the one thing that is uniform throughout the country is that you can't say in a healthcare proxy that I want my agent to ask the doctor for medicine that will end my life.
Okay.
You can ask to be taken off a ventilator. You can be asked to never go on a ventilator and other medical equipment, but you can't ask for aid in dying.
So you can ask for, don't put me on a feeding tube, don't put me on a ventilator, but you can't ask for assistance in dying.
Right, right. You know, this might be a good point to talk about Laura. This was a story that was reported in our local newspaper in August of 2015. And I knew Laura casually. She was the mother of a woman in our support group. She had Huntington's for many years. And she had a lot of cognitive problems. She was living in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which is not too far from the New York border. And you know, as you know, with many people with Huntington's, they reach a point where they can't pay their bills, they can't handle their finances, and this happened to her. And so, you know, she was kicked out on the street, lost her apartment, in and out of the local hospital. And, you know, she was a single woman, divorced woman, and her only, she had one daughter, woman that I know. And so some doctor in the Berkshire Medical Hospital decided that Laura was incompetent because she couldn't handle her finances and wanted her daughter, her designated healthcare proxy, to make medical decisions for her. So they made that decision, Laura, you're incompetent. And Danielle, the daughter, moved mom to the Huntington's facility in Vermont. And after a while, Laura decided that she didn't want to live like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they'd bring food tray, she would bring it back. And she stopped eating. She took some fluids, and that prolonged her life. But it took her 67 days. Took her 67 days to die.
Wow.
And
to starve to death.
And Vermont is a death with dignity state. So when I asked Danielle, I said to her, this was a death with dignity state. Even when it was near the end and the outcome was inevitable, why didn't somebody help her? And Danielle said to me, well, they told me that I need a court order. So what that means to me is that the doctors in Vermont were not going to second guess the incompetency decision that was made in Vermont, in Massachusetts, and Danielle didn't have the resources to go to court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hire somebody to examine her mom and come and testify and get a lawyer and all that. So, you know, that's what happened. I mean, so because she couldn't pay her rent and couldn't handle her finances, they determined that she was incompetent, but she clearly knew the difference between life and death because she returned the food tray and made the choice to stop eating. And so if you could do this through a healthcare proxy that survived incompetency, you wouldn't have to wait 67 days. And there are so many stories like this.
Yeah.
I know two people with ALS who chose to starve themselves to death before they had to go on a ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I also knew a man, he was in our support group, who made the decision, you know, not to have a feeding tube.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, of course, he couldn't talk. And he communicated his decision not to have a feeding tube to his dad by squeezing his hand in response to questions that his dad asked. So, you know, here's the dad having to watch his son, you know, die of starvation, just like had to watch her mother die of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be that way. These are people that are clearly about to make the passage. Why does it have to be so terrible? But they even in Vermont, a death with dignity law, because you can't do it through a healthcare proxy, nobody could help her. So that's why.
Because she had to do it herself.
You have to do it yourself. You have to tell the doctor. You have to tell the doctor orally what you want. And then you have to sign a document. And there's a 15-day waiting period in Oregon. And you have to swallow the medicine. They give you 100 barbiturates. You got to break it up and put it in water and mix it up and swallow it. And the law says self-administer, but in Oregon, it's been limited to swallowing. And people with Huntington's disease can't swallow.
Right.
So, you know, let's do what they do in Belgium, which is physician administered. So,
which could be
months,
through an IV or through a feeding tube.
Yes. But that's not swallowing. It would have to be the physician would have to do that.
Now,
you know,
do all the states in the United States have the same criteria that Oregon has?
In the several jurisdictions that have it, Oregon, Washington, Vermont, Montana, California, and the District of Columbia, and what I could see of the Colorado proposition, yes, the outline is basically the same.
A doctor has to say, well, you've got 6 months left.
Right, and you have to be an adult, so all the children are excluded.
Okay.
You have to be a resident of the state. And you have to be what they call capable. You have to be able to communicate. And the doctors have to...
And that has to be spoken and written.
Correct. And the doctors have to determine that you're within a natural death of 6 months, which is a very, very arbitrary period of time.
Hard to determine.
Yes, of course it's very hard to determine. There are people that live less and there are people that live longer.
Mm-hmm.
Is when they put the Oregon law together, they took the definition of terminal illness from the hospice law. You know, if you're familiar with hospice, to get into a hospice program, you have to be within 6 months of death. But what people don't realize is that when Congress enacted the hospice law as part of the Medicare Act in 1982, they were concerned over the cost of the new program. Congress wanted to put some fiscal constraints around the duration of the program in order to lower the cost to the federal treasury, and 6 months was their compromise. There's no moral, there's no ethical reason or relation to how long a person should be permitted to suffer. It's just an arbitrary time period.
And the motivation for that or the reasoning for that is the bottom line.
The bottom line, back in 1982.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And are there other states that are currently trying to pass a death with dignity law, or is it just limited to those six in D.C. that you've mentioned?
Well, no, I think there's about 20 states that have bills pending. I mean, we have a bill pending in New York, and I have spoken with the sponsors of the bill personally, the legislators themselves. I have spoken with many other legislators in New York about the bill that is pending. I have spoken with staff, many other legislators, including the leader of the Assembly, which is one of the two houses in the New York State Legislature. And I tell them, this law, this draft law as it exists in the bill in New York and as it is in Oregon and the other states, violates the Americans with Disability Act. And there's no reasonable accommodation. And I have a statement that's published in a book called Dying with Dignity by Professor Giza Lopes, where an Oregon senator was questioning an assistant attorney general out there on this subject, and he said, yeah, it does violate the Americans with Disability Act, and we're going to have to make some kind of reasonable accommodations, but they haven't done that. So, yeah.
What would the reasonable accommodations be? Would that be the using a healthcare proxy and not having to self-administer?
I think those would be the two biggest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine a person at the juncture of needing a feeding tube. Now, they need the feeding tube because they can't eat, can't swallow anymore.
Right.
And if they're not going to swallow, if they're not going to eat, they have about maybe 7 days to live, maybe a little longer if somehow they can swallow some water.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right? Is it just? Is it merciful to allow that person to suffer that way? Wouldn't a reasonable accommodation be to have that person say in advance that when that time comes, that's my choice, that's my value, I know the progression
mm-hmm.
of my illness, it for me, please let me die, make me die, give me an intravenous fluid that will end my suffering and put me to sleep. So, yes, I would say yes. A reasonable accommodation would be a healthcare proxy where the person chooses their course of action.
Uh-huh. And your argument to the physicians who don't see this as part of their job is that this is part of the continuum of care.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a very good way to...
Okay. Now, you mentioned that there are some countries outside the United States that have similar laws or some type of death with dignity laws. Are there any of those that you would like to tell us about?
Well, Switzerland is probably the most prominent and one that people should definitely know about because they do not have a residency requirement. And they've had their program since 1942. And basically what they did in Switzerland was they decriminalized assisted suicide. And anybody can help anybody else end their life as long as they are disinterested. There's no selfish motives. They have no financial relationship. Basically a stranger. And
mm-hmm.
In Switzerland, two groups emerged, and one group pretty much has doctors be involved and have doctors, you know, issue prescriptions, and they prefer not to take people who are not Swiss citizens. And the other group is open to aiding non-residents, non-citizens, and they find other ways. As you know, I don't know how many people have read the book Final Exit. It was a bestseller a long time ago, but in that book, the author talked a lot about using helium gas.
Hmm.
Helium gas is very painless, and unlike carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, you don't choke. So you put a
mm-hmm.
bag over your head and a tube to a canister of helium gas, and you inhale that for about 10 minutes or so. So Switzerland is the longest, 1942, and no, you don't have to be a resident. One of the things that's interesting about Belgium is that they have physician-administered, because, you know, in Oregon, there are a small percentage of people who cannot retain the medicine, and they vomit, and they regain consciousness, and don't get a second dose. So in Belgium, they approach that problem by having it be physician-administered. And they have a different standard. They don't have terminal illness. They have someone whose suffering is unbearable, and they are without prospect of improvement. So while that sounds a lot like a terminal illness, there's no 6 months, there's no time period. So there are other ways of defining the final stages of life without using a time period.
Mm-hmm.
And Not too long ago, Canada passed a program, and since Canada is our neighbor to the north of us, it's a little interesting to look at the Canadian law. It's broader than any of the laws in New York, in any of the United States jurisdictions. But we can't move to Canada. Someone must be a resident of Canada who's eligible for their single-payer insurance system. So, you know, if people are thinking, oh, I'll move to Canada, it's not so simple. You'd have to be there for a long time and qualify.
Yeah, I read something about that just the other day, that people talk about moving to Canada. Well, I don't like things the way they're being done here. I'll just move to Canada. And there's evidently quite an immigration process that you have to go through in order to move there.
I've never moved to Canada, so I don't know what involved. I do know, it's my understanding based on, you know, some NPR shows that I've listened to, that Canada does welcome immigrants, and they have a large.
But there's a process that you have to go through, and there's a waiting period, I think. So it's you can't just immediately move and become a resident.
Right, right. It's, you know, Compassion and Choices likes to talk about Brittany Maynard, who moved from California.
She was the young lady with brain cancer.
Yes, yes. And I've met her widower, Danielle Diaz. We were both on the radio talk show one day last February.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of cute because we chatted before the show started, but the studio was so small that only one person could get in it besides the moderator. So I waited in the hall while he went, and then when he was done, I went into the studio.
Oh, that's funny. So it was an actual studio and not a virtual studio like what we have.
Yeah, yeah, it was a closet in the capital of New York State. The radio
How
show.
Funny. Yeah.
Yeah, it originates in a corner of the press room on the third floor of the New York State Capitol. They have a corridor that's a press room, and then they have an office, and inside the office is this really tiny radio booth. So
it really is just like a little closet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's soundproof.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I guess it would have
but
to
anyway,
be.
But anyway, getting back, you know, they talk a lot about Brittany moving from California to Oregon so that she could have control over her destiny. And
because
somehow
it wasn't
she had
legal
to,
in California at the time.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay.
But if you look at these laws, they have some of the silliest residency requirements. And one of the things that I can't say that I'm 100% responsible for the change in the bill in New York, but I did draw it to the legislators' attention that the four criteria that are set out to establish residency really don't make a lot of sense. The first one is that you have to own or rent real property. How many senior citizens live in nursing homes or assisted living or move in with their children, no longer have property? The second is have a driver's license, and it says a driver's license,
that.
Not a governor's ID, not a government ID, but a driver's license. And the third is filed an income tax within the last year. And I can tell you, my daughter's on SSI. She hasn't filed an income tax return in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one is voting, and half the population doesn't vote anyway.
True.
So,
And so somebody with Huntington's isn't likely to still be registered to vote.
Right. 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 But people need to know that there are other models. The Oregon model is not the only model. And we have it right to our border. And it doesn't use 6 months. The person has to have a serious and incurable illness or disease. They have to be in an advanced state of irreversible decline. They have to be physically or psychologically suffering that they find intolerable, and their natural death is reasonably foreseeable. But that's
not an arbitrary time period on that.
Yes, gives the doctor a lot more flexibility.
Okay.
So,
and this
is
the law that Canada has.
Yes. Yes, the Supreme Court in Canada determined that Canadians have a constitutional right to assisted dying. And having made that decision, the legislature had to pass a law. And I'm not sure what the effective date was. It was sometime, I think, within the last 6 months, certainly no more than.
So who does benefit from the Oregon model law? Certainly wouldn't be HD patients.
It's pretty much cancer. About 80% of people, and it varies. You know, it's not the same every year, but the approximately 80% are people with cancer. And the second largest are people with respiratory illnesses. And like I said before, you know, they're white and they're upper middle class. And I don't know who pays for it. I don't know if the individual pays for it. The advocates from Compassion and Choices like to tell people that it's paid for under hospice. I don't know about that. I know that there's a federal law that prevents federal funding for any form of assistance. And so it's not going to be covered under Medicare, and it's not going to be covered under Medicaid. So,
and probably not under private insurance.
You know, I don't know who pays for it. I don't know. It's my opinion, based on the New York insurance law, that insurance companies only pay for things that are reasonable and necessary to treat a disease or an illness. And the only exception to that is a few very, very specified cancer experiments. So experimental medicine is not covered by insurance. And the interesting thing about the bill in New York and the Oregon bill or the Oregon model that Compassion and Choices is pushing throughout the nation is there is no amendment to the insurance law that would clearly say that it has to be covered by an insurance company. At least
so somebody might want to do it, but if they don't have the resources to pay for it, they wouldn't be able to carry out their wishes.
That's the way I see it, but I don't, you know, there are no statistics that I'm aware of on who pays for it. And you know, I don't think the prescription is terribly expensive. But I think the doctor's time is, particularly all the paperwork that the doctors have to do.
Right. Right.
So, and I think part
but
of
But I wonder how the total cost of compares to, let's say, 6 months of hospital and nursing home care. I have a feeling that the 6 months of care would be a lot more expensive. But I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So, you know, we were talking about Europe and some statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And just to give an example of how different it is, if you looked at Oregon between 1997, which is when the law actually was implemented after the litigation ended, and 2013, there were only 1,173 terminally ill people in Oregon who asked for the aid. And during that same time period in Holland...
That's in 16 years, right?
Yeah. In
so
Holland,
that's less
it was
than 100 people a year, okay?
Right.
And during
and it was
that
very,
same
very,
time period?
In that same time period, it was 25,000 in Holland. And while Holland has, you know, four times the population of Oregon, you would expect it to be 5,000 if it was just a matter of population difference, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's done very differently in Holland. Otherwise, you know, the numbers would be closer.
And how does their law differ from the Oregon model? In Holland or the Netherlands?
Well, the law in there is called the Termination of Life on Request and Assisted Suicide Act of 2002, and it allows Dutch doctors, upon a patient's request, to prescribe or administer lethal medication to individuals whose suffering, which is both physical or psychological, is unbearable and without any prospect of improvement. And they also allow minors between the ages of 12 and 15, if their parents consent.
Mm-hmm.
And 16 and 17-year-olds are also allowed to make these decisions, but the parents have to be involved. You know, we forget that there are a lot of children with brain cancer that's terminal. There's a lot of children who have terminal forms of Hodgkin's disease and leukemia. Not every child gets cured.
Right.
Even have great, great progress in those areas. And of course, you know, we have our own juvenile form, and I'm not suggesting that an 8-year-old should choose it, but certainly if somebody had a juvenile form and they were in the late stages and, you know, they were 17 or 18, you know, they should be given a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the differences between Holland and Oregon. It's a larger group of people who are eligible. The qualifications are broader. They don't have a
mm-hmm.
six-month time period. But they still have to be terminally ill. They don't use those words. They just say, you know, no prospect of improvement.
Mm-hmm. And it allows
right.
the doctors to not only prescribe but to administer the medication if needed.
Right, right. I have no expectation that any state in the United States would adopt a European model. But I think it's important to know that there are other models out there besides Oregon.
Mm-hmm. So what should the Huntington's community do, in your opinion?
We have to stand up. If we don't advocate for ourselves, nobody else will. There are countless examples about how people with Huntington's fall through the cracks of our medical delivery system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know, you know, my daughter encountered all kinds of situations where she couldn't get into programs because she didn't have a mental illness or she didn't have traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
And until recently, it was very, very hard to get Social Security disability. And this just goes on and on and on. And not every state that has medical marijuana allows people with Huntington's to use medical marijuana. Those states list the illness, not every state list includes Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
And so we as a community have to make our voices heard. We have to talk with our elected representatives. We have to write them. We have to let them know that we want the same choices, freedoms, and controls that are given to other people.
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation is the healthcare proxy. Let each person decide according to their own values, their own beliefs, and the progression of their disease when they've had enough. And have that healthcare proxy work even if the person is later determined to be incompetent. So we have to write our lawmakers, we have to write our governors, and we have to write the national advocates, the compassion and choice people, maybe the National Center for Death with Dignity, and beg them to move off the Oregon model so as to include the HD community, and it doesn't hurt to say other people like the ALS community, that we want to be included. We want to have choices, just like the person with cancer is going
mm-hmm.
to have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we've got to do. And if we don't stand up, nobody's going to stand up for us.
Unfortunately, that is the truth. We've seen that over and over again in the Huntington's community. If we don't do it, nobody else is going to.
That's the American system. That's the way it is in America. Legislators don't know that there's a problem unless some constituency brings it to their attention. Now, I'll tell you a story that proves my point. And then
maybe we'll
wrap up. Just about a year ago, I met with Governor Cuomo's Assistant Secretary, Assistant Deputy Secretary for Health. And she brought a policy person from the State Health Department. And we chatted in the Capitol for about a half an hour. And I walked out of the building with the policy person from the health department. And she said to me, "Alan, I am so glad you came in to talk to us. You're the first person to do so. And we had no idea that there were other ways to do this."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So that says it all, that personal contact and letting people know through your own personal stories, letting your representatives know what it is you're asking for. Yeah.
Right. That's absolutely
right.
Well,
Alan, thank you so much for having the courage to talk about this and for your advocacy. I appreciate you sharing this information with our community so that people can make their own decisions about how they feel about death with dignity or assisted suicide or right to die or whatever term you want to give it. We need to be educated. We need to be informed before we make up our minds about issues that are as important as this.
And
I appreciate
you, Sharon,
you doing that.
And thank you for all that you do. You're a wonderful role model, and all the folks that are associated with Help for 4D. It's a blessing, and I thank you, and it's an honor to be here with you today. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
I appreciate that. Are there any last thoughts you want to share before we wrap up?
Anybody got any questions? We get any questions?
I have not seen any questions. So I guess not.
Okay.
I want to remind our listeners that we have over 250 archived programs. You can go on our Blog Talk Radio show and listen to any of those episodes that have been archived. We have an audience of over 97,000 listeners and growing. Please share this with other people you know who are living with Huntington's. It's our mission to bring credible and accurate information to our community. Be sure to check out our website, www.helpforhd.org, for upcoming events, for resources, and for articles in the Huntington's Post. And we will talk to you next time. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike, you know.
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your moves.
Get hooked on Tuesday at Bonefish Grill with our three-course menu. You get a salad, your choice of entree like our new cod piccata, sirloin steak, or chicken teriyaki bowl, and an amazing dessert for only $14.99. So hurry in every Tuesday. And don't forget, stone crabs are back at Bonefish Grill, fresh off the Florida docks and served the way they were meant to be served. Chilled, cracked, and ready for dipping in our signature house-made mustard sauce. Come see what's in season at Bonefish Grill.